Welcome to the Lions Den University Report. This program brings you a behind-the-scenes look at the spiritual life on today's university and college campuses. Now here's your host, Glenn Bailey.
The following program was previously broadcast.
At the universities, in the study of science, there are those who hold a position which is known these days as intelligent design, that the facts of science point to a design in nature that cannot be explained by random natural processes. Before you even talk about who the designer is, we believe the designer is Jesus Christ, that he's the creator of the universe, the savior of the world. He lived a perfect life when he entered human history, died on the cross for our sins, and rose again on that first Easter Sunday morning, and that we can know him and know the forgiveness that he provided on the cross, and know a place in heaven will be ours if we're trusting in him. But we're here today at Lehigh University in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, with one of our guests who's been on our program a number of times and is familiar with many of our listeners, I'm sure, Dr. Michael Behe in the biology department of Lehigh University. And Mike, welcome to our microphones once again.
Thanks. It's always a pleasure.
And it's our pleasure to have you with us and to know of your scientific expertise and dealing with this issue and being willing to take on what is many times a hostile issue for a lot of people today.
Well, it's I'm a biochemist, so my job is to study the molecular and cellular foundations of life, and I just want to do my job and try to figure out where it came from. And you know, if that doesn't make some people happy, well, that's what it is anyway. And
right. Well, unfortunately, you're in a small minority on our university campuses. I don't think you'll argue with that.
No, that's quite true. But I think that the data aren't on my side. So I'd rather have the data on my side and
right
than the people.
Great. Now, for our new listeners, perhaps there's someone who hasn't heard one of our interviews or hasn't read your book, Darwin's Black Box. Maybe share a little bit of your background in science and how long you've been here as a professor of biology at Lehigh.
Well, I have been in science ever since I studied chemistry in college and then biochemistry in graduate school, got a PhD. And
where did you do your studies again?
I did my undergraduate at Drexel University in Philadelphia, and then graduate at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, and graduated there in 1978. Did a postdoctoral study at the National Institutes of Health near Washington, D.C.
Right.
And then I got my first job at the Queens College of the City University of New York in the early 80s, and around 1985, I moved to Lehigh University, where we've been living ever since.
All right. And so you've been a professor here in the biology department. What kind of things do you teach here at Lehigh?
Well, I'm a biochemist, so I teach biochemistry-related courses. There's a two-semester general biochemistry course that biology students and biochemistry students and chemical engineers take. And there's also advanced courses in the area. There's one called physical biochemistry, and there are graduate courses in the area on protein structure and nucleic acid structure. And those are the sorts of things I teach.
Right. Okay. And you were sharing with me that you, as our listeners know, you've taken the position that the things like the irreducible complexity of organisms in the cell and in life speak of a designer rather than random natural processes. But you recently did an article, I understand, or published something relating to this subject of evolution. What was it that you published, and what was the analysis that you made?
Well, yes, I just recently had published an article in a biology journal called the Quarterly Review of Biology. And it publishes review articles where the author goes and reads on a particular topic widely and tries to synthesize and sum up the results and glean as much from it as possible and report back to the readers. And the topic of my article was evolution, experimental evolution. In the past couple decades, a number of scientists have done evolutionary experiments in the laboratory in the hopes of seeing what evolution was capable of and what paths it took, and a variety of questions. And although one usually thinks of evolution as going very, very slowly, if you use rapidly reproducing organisms like viruses and bacteria, then you can actually get results within the time that before your grant expires. And I went back, and the gist of it is that a number of beneficial mutations were seen in these experiments, and that was touted early on by many evolutionists as evidence that their theory works. And it is. It is evidence that you can get beneficial mutations that help a bacterium or virus survive. But it's only been in the recent past 5 or 10 years that techniques have been developed where we can actually look at the particular gene and the particular piece of the bacterium or the virus that has changed, that has mutated, and tell why it was improved. And it turns out that in many of these cases, almost all of them, the improvement was due to the bacterium throwing away a gene, getting rid of a piece of DNA, or a virus getting rid of a piece of its DNA. So it turns out that sometimes you can actually get rid of part of your genome, and that helps. That actually helps the bacterium survive. And I can give you an analogy to, you know, this strikes people as odd sometimes.
Right. Of how the gene losing a bit of information can be temporarily helpful. Or offer some helpful change.
Well, here's actually not an analogy here. Well, here's an analogy. Then I'll tell you a case in nature that is very similar to it. Suppose you lived in a city that had a river flowing right in front of it, and there was one bridge across the river to the other side. And you saw on the other side an army massing, and it was going to come across and invade your city and wreck everything. What could you do to save yourself, save the city? You could blow up the bridge.
Right.
That's easy enough. And that would be a beneficial change as far as you're concerned. But it doesn't tell you how to build a bridge. Destroying a bridge is not the same thing as building one. Well, it turns out that some beneficial changes in organisms are exactly like that. Consider the case of malaria, which is a disease that is still very prominent in many portions of the world, kills 1 million humans a year.
We got a letter, dengue virus fever down in Paraguay right now is a problem, and a problem from the mosquitoes there.
Yeah, so that's right.
These diseases that we don't have in America is still active.
That's correct. We even used to have it in America, malaria, up until about World War II or so, it turns out. Even north as far as Boston, they had outbreaks of malaria. But these days, it's concentrated mostly in equatorial regions of the world. But the malaria parasite turns out to be a single-celled organism which lives in the mosquito and then is transferred to a human when a mosquito bites the human. And the malaria tries to invade a red blood cell. If it can invade a red blood cell, it goes inside and it eats the hemoglobin, the protein that carries oxygen. It eats all of the stuff inside the red blood cell and uses that to make about 20 copies of itself, then bursts out, and each of the 20 copies attaches to another red blood cell, and in the next round, 400 burst out, and in the next round, 8,000. But in some populations in West Africa, a protein, which is like a little molecular machine, which usually is found on the surface of the red blood cell, is missing. And if you do genetic analysis, you find that There's been a mutation in this population of people in which they deleted the gene for that protein. And it turns out that the malaria has to attach itself to that very protein in order to squirm into the red blood cell. So it's just like blowing up a bridge. The organisms, the people got rid of the bridge that the malarial parasite, the invading army, needed to invade the city. And so that's a positive beneficial mutation, but it's a degradative mutation. It doesn't build things, it destroys them.
Right, great. And now you have to use the illustration, too, that you told me over lunch as well about the car. That is really clear, I think, in terms of, your point here.
It turns out that degrading things is oftentimes beneficial. So suppose you had a car, and suppose you wanted your car to go faster. So what you thought is that if you decrease the wind resistance of your car, well, it'd go faster. So what is the quickest way that you could decrease the wind resistance to your car? Well, you could break off the side view mirrors. You know, that might work. You know, now you no longer have those, you know, bucking the wind as you're going down the highway. And of course, you can't use the side view mirrors anymore, but, well, maybe you don't need them right now. And so that taking things away can help sometimes, but taking things away or breaking them or degrading them does not show you how to build anything. It doesn't show you how to build a side view mirror, doesn't show you how to build a bridge if you blow one up. And Darwinian evolution is great at breaking things. Random mutation is great at breaking things because your genome is just chock full of finely tuned molecular and cellular machinery, and almost any change to it messes something up. So if breaking something is beneficial, then Darwinian processes is just right for you. But if you need to build something, you'd better look around for something else.
All right. And so when it boils down to it, a lot of it is information. And where did all the information come from that makes up even one single cell? And as you've said at our microphones before, the average person recognizes design in nature that it takes an education to miss it.
That's right. Yeah, sometimes people ask me, what do you teach your children about creation versus evolution? And I say, well, until they're in their biology high school course, I don't teach them anything because any child is smart enough to grasp the design in nature. You've got to be educated out of that knowledge. So if you just let them explore nature on their own and teach them how it works, they'll have a very strong innate understanding of design.
Right. And unfortunately, our universities in many ways try to undo that, I think, and we are concerned that both sides be offered and shared, and especially because we believe we're not here by accident, but by the intelligent design of a creator who loves us and offered us salvation through Jesus Christ. But even to present the non-religious perspective, as you present it, of intelligent design, there's great hostility. And we're going to continue our interview in our next segment and talk a little bit more about perhaps how hostile it is to take this position that the universe is not an accident of random processes, but the wonderful design of a magnificent creator. And so my guest for this interview has been Dr. Michael Behe here at Bethlehem, Pennsylvania at Lehigh University. And again, thanks, Mike, for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You have been listening to the Lion's Den University Reports. If you would like more information about the Christian life or would like to contact the Lion's Den or one of the guests, please write us at the Lion's Den, Post Office Box 226, Mifflinburg, Pennsylvania 17844, or email ltcldur@yahoo.com.